This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome, new and regular listeners. This is Lana. Well, I've been quite busy with my attention in other areas, but I'm back in the saddle with more radio shows. When I take a couple weeks off to focus on other things, it feels like months have gone by in media world when I come back. And I admit, it can feel really nice to disconnect from the constant onslaught by media and the internet world. Also, we're preparing for our special Red Ice anniversary celebration, which will be an all-day live stream featuring various friends and guests and members calling in. Henrik started Red Ice 10 years ago. Soon we'll be unveiling our new website design, and we're adding a new weekend live stream show for members, which we'll talk about in April. Speaking of members, we were in New York recently, and I had the pleasure of meeting a couple longtime listeners, and I have to say, all the Red Ice members I have met have been impressive people. So thank you all for your support through the years. Just when you think you've talked about it all, new areas begin to open up. I see that starting to happen as this pro-European movement is growing and evolving, getting shaken up a bit, which I think is a good thing. My guest today is not someone you know, but she did contact me wanting to discuss the Russian Bolshevik Revolution, and I, of course, am always up for learning more about that time. Her name is Sencha McRae, and her passion is history and questioning the official story. She runs the website untoldtales.net. If you're Russian, you'll probably enjoy this one, but we also wander around a bit and talk about Trump and America's flavor of communism. Sencha McRae coming up. Welcome, Sencha. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
So I got to ask, have you been watching what's going on with Trump?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think about it? It seems like left and right has united against him.
It's weird. It's very weird because on the one hand, there's this united group from both sides against him. And then there are all these sort of mainstream small town Americans who are cheering him on. And of course, people are desperate about the immigration. They're desperate about jobs. They're beginning to realize something is seriously, seriously wrong. Is this their guy? Is this another phony? His Israeli connections are really
funny. It's almost like this is our last chance before this country is just completely taken over.
Oh, yeah. But the wall, I mean, the wall isn't going to keep people out. That border is maintained by Mexicans.
Yeah.
On our side. It's foolish. Someone's going to make a lot of money. That's how I see it, my most cynical side.
And further, just legal immigration is enough. You know, I was up in New York. I know you're from the D.C. area. We walked around D.C. and we were a white minority looking at all of the monuments.
Oh, absolutely. I grew up in that town and, you know, well, a long time ago. I have to date myself. But in any case, I didn't know that in the 40s and 50s, D.C. was 30% black. It is today 70%, but then you look at that northwest sector that you were in, where all the monuments are, that's all third world now.
Yeah,
it's and I saw it recently. It's incredible.
Yeah, it was pretty much every cab driver was India, Africa, or Middle Eastern. And I'm thinking, wait, you come here to drive a cab? Seriously, you know?
Right. Tells you something about life in Africa, Middle East, and India, doesn't it?
You were part of a think tank in D.C., correct?
Yes, I did. I worked for one. I was actually in my liberal days, and that's where I got disillusioned. This was the peace movement back at the beginning of the Persian Gulf War, way back when. What I discovered was that there was a certain group of people who seemed to be involved, heavily involved on both sides. So from there, I began to think things out. I mean, I saw the stuff going on the Hill. You know, these Jewish operatives were running the leftist, the big peace movement, and then here they were advising on the neocon side, the government.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, yeah, at that point, I got very disillusioned and I began to look at things. And that's when my curiosity was piqued and I started, and that's a long time ago now. So I have learned a lot.
And when did you start becoming really interested? It sounds like you've been into it for a while, but you came from a liberal background. When did you start becoming interested in issues that concern Europeans and race and culture and all of that?
Well, in the last, I'd say about 7 years, because finally, I mean, things are, you know, you put things because it's the way we're taught to think in categories. I began to realize that the government of Washington, D.C. was A, insane, B, incompetent. and three, criminal. And of course, there was this growing arrogance in the black population of Washington, D.C. That was part of it. I also realized who was controlling the left. Then I traveled actually back to Europe. I had this notion I was going to go back there and live, and then I saw what was going on in Europe.
Yeah.
So, you know, eventually I started to put the pieces together.
So now you've been on that trail for quite a while, right? You said
yeah,
7 years or
yeah,
so?
Yeah, about 7 years. It took a long while. It took a couple of years for me to deal with the reality of race because I was so programmed, we all are, to not talk about it, to deny it, to discuss everything in ideological terms. And of course, ideology is part of the battle, but it's not the whole battle. And then you just begin to realize, wow, I am becoming a stranger in a strange land. And this is my country.
Yep. I know. It's awful. I mean, I'm not that old and I've seen a drastic change. Yeah. Jeez, where are we going to be 20 years from now? So how did you become interested in the Russian Revolution of all things?
How did I get into the Russian thing? I'm trying to figure out where this started. Well, I was interested in history anyway. And a lot of information, a massive amount of information is out on the internet at this point about Germany, of course, and the destruction of Germany, and Germany before World War I and after World War I and the Versailles Treaty, and after World War II and the absolute destruction, blah, blah, blah. Very important stuff. But then I was looking at this whole other story, the Russian story. And of course, I went to the movies. I saw Dr. Zhivago. I think I was 13. I loved it. But then I started thinking about how the story was represented to us. And not just that, but in, what was that movie, Reds?
Oh, yeah.
And the Bolsheviks are always idealized, and they're just sweet, sweet people trying
yes,
to help human
exactly.
beings. And I just got kind of cynical about this. And I got curious about it. Well, what started and triggered it even more is my mother had a very dear friend who was Danish. And she lived in the United States. She died there, but the family had a memorial service in Denmark. And I went with her to sort of manage the thing because she was elderly at that point. And when I was there, I thought, oh my God, I'm practically in Russia. I'm going. And I'll be back in a week or two, Mom. And she said, do you think this is a good idea? This was in 1993. So it was right as things were changing. And I thought, what an incredible opportunity to see this country. And I got there. And what I saw, I mean, there were so many things. That's a story in and of itself. But I saw what had happened to the Russian people and how frightened they were, how poor they were. I remember going down, it's Nevsky Prospect, is that how it's pronounced?
Sounds right.
The main street in St. Petersburg, all these huge five-star hotels, and you walk around the corner, and you see a little drugstore, and it has one item.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of contrast. It's kind of a funny story. I got there in St. Petersburg late at night, and I got into a cab with a Spaniard. And I speak Spanish, so we chatted, and then he got dropped off, and here I am with this cab driver, young kid. He can't find my hotel, save his life. So he invited me home, and I was like, oh, my God, what are my chances here? And I thought, well, on the other hand, he probably lives with his mom and his dad. And sure enough, he did. He lived with his mom and his dad and his sister and two dogs in about 600 square feet.
Oh, yeah.
And walked to the tiny space. The wallpaper was old Life magazine covers. The enamel on the plumbing was completely worn out. They were so poor, but they were so sweet.
I remember I was there actually in 95 with my parents. And
really?
Yeah. And I remember we rented a little flat and, my family knows some people there as we're Russian, and they were connected with some others there. And there wasn't hot water all the time. Just ran during certain times. And of course, anytime I wanted to take a bath, there was never any hot water. So I had to heat up a bunch of pots and pans with water. Yeah. Right. And I remember there were still lines for people in the bakery. I mean, grocery shopping was an all day affair because there wasn't much there. So you had to wait in line to get what was there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's take a look at the early years of the Bolshevik coup. You mentioned a Western journalist, Malcolm Muggeridge. Is that how you say his name?
Right. He wrote a book called Winter in Moscow. Now, Malcolm Muggeridge was a leftist. He was probably part of that Bloomsbury crowd in London, and they were all commies, and they loved Russia. And, I mean, it was the great experiment. So he went there. And he stayed there, and he saw what was going on, and it was exactly the opposite of what he had been led to believe. And he wrote this book, and he talked about the blindness of journalists, which was fascinating because, of course, he was one. And he talked about what he saw and how carefully contrived the facade was if you went to Moscow. But he went outside the city, and he went to the countryside, and he saw exactly what was happening to those people. And he was horrified. So he came back to London, and he was all head up and very sincere and tried to tell people, well, he got shut down. His career was ruined. You can't buy the book anymore. They had one printing. They do what they always do. They shut out this information. And what he saw was not only the arrogance of this establishment in Moscow, and it was a combination of these Western so-called journalists who were told anything, and they were told what they wanted to believe, and these operatives of the great experiment. And then he went in, as I say, he went into the country, and he saw, I mean, these villages that were simply destroyed. They had been burned down. The people had all been shipped off to Siberia. Awesome. Mass murder. I mean, just it's almost incomprehensible, this industrialized mass murder of the very people, if you stop and think about it, that the Bolsheviks, the communists, the leftists are always saying they love. And that's the poor people. Now, they call them the proletariat. That would be the working class in the factories. But the people they destroyed were the peasantry, the farm peasantry. They hated these people.
Why?
It's crazy. I stopped and thought, why did they go after them to the degree that they did? And the only conclusion I can come to is they were independent. They started in on the Ukrainians. And their figures vary on that genocide. And it was a genocide by starvation. And when you start thinking about it, you can only really kill millions of people by using natural forces. You're not going to use technology. That doesn't work. They had starvation and, of course, Siberia. But the numbers vary from 7 million to 11 million, according to Ukrainian sources. They went into that part of the country. It was the breadbasket. The peasantry was independent. They did not like Jews. Most of the Bolsheviks were Jews. We can get back to that. But they had a couple hundred year tension because they had been exploited before. The Soviets went into the Ukraine. They killed off the intelligentsia. They killed off the writers. They killed off the leaders. And then they started to requisition their food. And they took everything. They would not leave them with a sack of potatoes.
Didn't they even kill the horses and the cattle?
Yeah, they kill the animals. The one horse, and this is, I mean, it's so horrifying. One horse was left alive, and this was a horse that pulled a cart that picked up the bodies in the streets during the day. And this horse had to be protected because it was healthy. Someone would have killed him and eaten him. That was one animal left. Anyway, you can see pictures on the internet of this genocide, starving people, reduced to eating their clothing, their belts, infant children. It's horrifying, but of course, we don't know starvation. We have no idea.
Yeah, I heard stories of people who were afraid to let their kids wander by themselves because they might get eaten.
Yeah, it's hardcore and it's horrible. But you look at these photographs and you see these absolute skeletons. And when you're that emaciated as a child, I mean, you're going to die. And most of them did. And you're never going to grow to be a normal adult. Well, so they killed them off this way. But they also did it to the Russian peasants. Another 6 million of that class, the kulaks, were also given the same treatment. And they were going into villages and just cleaning them out. I mean, they did just gun down old women and children and old men and just kill off the peasantry. And then whatever was left, who might be healthy enough, got shipped off to Siberia, and they generally spent their lives there in a horrific, horrific, horrific conditions. Just impossible to believe. But they built the industrial state of the Soviet Union by using this forced slave labor, and they worked them to death.
Yeah.
So millions and millions died up there.
I actually had a great-grandfather who was in one of those camps. He didn't want to pay taxes for, you know, he had some hydropower on his property, and he also was a business owner, and he was basically rebelling, you know. They put him in jail for a while and then in a camp. And there's an actual story there of his family that broke him out. They actually snuck him out. He escaped from one of these camps, but then he died 3 days later because the conditions are so horrible. You know, they're starving and sick.
Yeah. Oh, just, I mean, the descriptions of what they went through. And I mean, first of all, Siberia is bitter, bitter, bitter cold. 10 months of bitter winter, dark. They didn't have adequate clothing. They would, you know, try to drag their pant legs around their feet so they wouldn't get frostbite in bed, what beds they had. I mean, the food was horrible. What food there was, dry bread, you know, rotten vegetables. And so they just worked till they dropped. And they did this to millions and millions of people who, as you say, they were just, I mean, some of these people were in prison because they showed up late for work one day. So they were just looking to find people to put to work, and any excuse would do.
Now, what about the death of the royal family? What happened there? Because I know it was awfully violent.
It was. They were Tsar Nicholas and the Tsarina and the four girls and the little boy, who was a hemophiliac, in any case, a very fragile child. They were being kept in a house in Ekaterinburg, I guess, and there was an order, and this is an interesting detail. This came directly from the top, from Lenin, because there's a copy of the telegraph that he sent Sverdlov, who was the one in charge of the assassination, to go ahead and do it. So there is proof that it was done and that the orders came from the top. So they took them into the basement, and they just gunned them all down. And then they bayoneted the daughters to make sure they were dead. And they didn't want this family, I mean, they would never have let them survive because it could have been a rallying point and a center focus of the people of Russia, who, contrary to what we've been told, did not hate the Tsar and he wasn't a monster, they would have rallied around him. So they had to prevent that happening. And so they did.
Yeah, he's another one of those demonized men in history, that's for sure.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, very definitely. So they got rid of all of them. And that was the end of that. And they took over the government. And this kind of mass transformation of a state apparatus. You know, you can never make changes that quickly without violence. But they did, of course, with violence. And they took over everything. And decided, of course, they had this idea about the proletariat, which is, I guess, I have my suspicions that, and I've seen this in other instances in history, where the food producers have to be destroyed. Because once you don't have that level of independence, you really are just prey to the power of the state. And also, these people were taken from the country and forced into the cities. And you can be watched more carefully and more, you know, more easily in a city environment than you can spread around the countryside.
Now, do you know what the climate was like for religion? Was it mostly Christians that were killed? Were the Bolsheviks religious at all, or did they outlaw some of these things, spiritual practices at the time?
They went after the Christians. The Russians were very Christian. They did target them. We hear that this was a revolution against capitalism, but they didn't destroy the banks. And as a matter of fact, the banks in the West actually funded the revolution. That's another part of the story. But yeah, they destroyed lots of churches, lots of religious schools. They targeted the priest. The nuns, they were particular victims of their wrath. And they were just, their technique of torture, it was so sadistic. I mean, I have heard, I'm not going to go into this too much. It's a little sickening, but these things need to be said. For instance, they would torture someone in the basement and just till they were near dead, and then bring them up and tie them to the post on a dock in the winter rain, in the winter climate, till they were just destroyed through wind, snow, rain, the waves of the ocean. I mean, it's bizarre sadism, or cutting someone's intestine and nailing it and forcing them to run around a table till they drop dead.
Ugh.
It's any mind that can think these things up is insane.
Yeah, you have to have quite a level of hatred to be able to do that as well.
Yeah, you do. You have to be sick in your mind to put anybody through this. But yeah, they did. They targeted the Christian religion. In the case of the Russians, of course, that was the Orthodox. There was an Orthodox church that was kept going. So as these things happen, you know, some folks will say, okay, I'm ready to compromise. And they were kept alive as the official church, but I think they were very controlled by the Bolshevik government from the very beginning. They, as I said, they also went after class. It was a class war as well. For instance, in St. Petersburg, they would send out these vans at night to collect the people they didn't like, and that would include academics, business class, professionals, anybody who had any, you know, status or education. Again, you have to get rid of those people. And that's what the statement that they made, that we simply have to get rid of this entire class. I call them the bourgeoisie. And the bourgeoisie were basically the Gentile ruling class of Russia.
Yeah, the aristocracy.
Aristocracy. They had to get rid of them. So they did. And then, of course, at that time in history, the one mistake the Tsar had made was to get into World War I, and that devastated Russia. And the people were angry. They came back angry. They didn't want to fight this war. And that's when the Mensheviks made their move, and the Bolsheviks went in right after them and took over.
Tell us about the letter from Solovetsky, the concentration camp in Siberia.
Oh, God. This was written by the inmates. And it was written towards the end of that period. And, of course, those camps were kept going for 75 years. So that was a very, very long time. And, again, they were in Siberia. It was bitter cold. This letter was pleading with the government to let them go home. They wanted to go home to die, basically. I mean, they had no lives left. A few of these people had actually survived this. And they talked about, you know, the arbitrary killings and why they were put there and these ridiculous charges, no charges at all, and forced to stay there for decades and humiliated. One of them talks about being forced to eat their feces. So again, it's when you do this to people, you degrade them so much. You know, they have to start losing their minds. To my mind, to suffer that much, such, you know, unbelievable brutality. But anyway, so they wanted to go home, and they never did get a right to go home. They never got bus fare home to Moscow or whatever little town, you know. And it's, of course, this brings me to the whole concept of the right of return that the Jews claim that they have to Israel, and they can go there no matter where they are, from any part of the world, and it's paid for. And yet, look at this story in the Bolshevik Revolution, which was largely their doing. So, It was their revolution or their coup and takeover.
Oh yeah. And wasn't the Tsar kind and he let the Jews come seek shelter in Russia? And then the Bolsheviks rose up after that.
You know, that's an interesting part of the story. The Tsar inherited, in the 19th century, they got the Polish Jews because of a land transfer. So they got this mass of people that they really couldn't absorb. And they were already living, actually, in Poland, in the Ukraine, and in that western part. Tsar didn't particularly want them to come in mass into Russia, but he did allow them slowly. He encouraged education, and these Polish Jews were then educated by the Russians, and they became professionals, got into the military. It was done at a rather slow pace. The objection to it came not from the intelligentsia, the Russian aristocracy, the Tsar. It came from the rabbis. They did not want their people being assimilated. But when they became assimilated, they started up this communist cells and propaganda and took over the newspapers and created all these political groups to bring down Russia. And they kept at it throughout the 19th century. So they were active there before. It didn't happen overnight. They had been setting this up for a very, very long time. And in fact, that's another interesting sidelight to this is they assassinated a lot of, I think they assassinated most to the Tsars since about 1780, including the last one. And they also assassinated the last Tsar's ministers because they were trying very hard also to alleviate conditions for the Russian peasantry. And had this particular minister, what was his name? Solyapin. He was enacting all these land transfer grants. And so had he been successful, the Bolsheviks wouldn't have had any way to justify this revolution. So they had to get rid of him. So yeah, no, the Jews were not brutalized and tortured day and night and all this stuff that they always come up with to, you know, of course that's their hue and cry about everything, their whole history. But actually, there was caution. There was a certain distrust on the part of the Russians because they had had a bad history with the Jews. They had exploited their people, particularly the peasants. They ran the alcohol industry. I mean, it was like 70% Jewish controlled in the Russia of the 19th century. And they exploited these people. And they would drink, lose their land, and the Tsar and his ministers were trying to prevent this kind of social tension and exploitation of their own people.
There were some other massacres in Estonia and Latvia. What can you tell us about those?
Well, they also massacred people there. I'd have to go through things to get the numbers, but I don't think that's that important. But they organized, massacres in the Baltic countries, massacres in Poland, massacres in, all the Eastern European countries. Once they had taken charge of Russia, they went for Eastern Europe. And of course, they got Eastern Europe after World War II. Franklin Delano Roosevelt gave it to them, and Churchill. When Churchill and Roosevelt and Stalin met at the Yalta Conference, they just basically gave him Eastern Europe. It was incredible. I mean, they had already made forays in there, but it was contested territory. So it was a whole, they had this concept of a world revolution and that they were going to take over. And that's in their own writing. I would have to, let me see. Oh, let me just read one little quote.
Of course.
People who don't believe this. And this comes from the April 4th, 1919 Jewish Chronicle. And it said, quote, "There is much in the fact of Bolshevism itself, in the fact that so many Jews are Bolshevist, in the fact that the ideals of Bolshevism at many points are consonant with the finest ideals of Judaism."
Well, that explains why anti-Semitism was a capital crime in 1918, right?
Right. Yes, it was. Capital crime. So where's all this talk about, you know, and because they keep trying to promote this idea that the Soviet Union was anti-Semitic when it was their revolution.
Yeah, I've heard that many times.
And here's another one, and this one comes from a Gentile, so of course it's suspect. The widow of the Guardian's correspondent, Mrs. Ariadna Williams, wrote, quote, "In the Soviet Republic, all the committees and commissaries were filled with Jews." And then one from a British, again, he was the Russian correspondent of the Times, the London Times, and this man's name was Robert Wilton. In 1920, he published a book on in French, The Last Days of the Romanovs, which gave the racial background of all the members of the Soviet government. It did not appear in English, interestingly enough. After the publication of this huge work, Wilton was ostracized by the press, and he died in poverty in 1925. And actually, I can, just to give you some idea, because lists are a little tiresome, but to make the point, he told his readers at that point that the Central Committee of the Bolshevik Party was made up as follows. Now, there were 12 members, 9 of whom were Jewish. Bronstein, we know him as Trotsky, he took a Russian name, but he was Jewish. And then Apfelbaum, we know him as Zinoviev, those people who pay attention to stuff, that was his Russian name, he was Jewish. Laurie, his Russian name was Larine, he was Jewish. And so on down the line, there were 3 Russians. Then there was another one of these ruling bodies, and this was the Council of the People's Commissars. And out of this number, I think there were 36, going to the Central Executive Committee, the top body. Out of the 60 in total, 42 were Jewish. 5 were Russians. And then in addition, of course, they brought in foreigners. There were 2 Armenians, 6 Lithuanians, 1 German, 2 Georgians, 1 Czech, and 1 Ukrainian. So in other words, the ruling body of the Russian state or the Soviet Union was not Russian at all. So that's really a foreign takeover.
Yeah, of course. Well, that would explain why, too. I mean, even today, I just heard recently Russian state media, I know Russia's suspect once again, but they were saying that, oh, the Holodomor never happened, but Holocaust denial should be illegal. Have you heard about this?
I didn't know that they said the Holodomor hadn't happened.
Yeah. And that's unbelievable that that's happening.
That's unbelievable. I know. Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know how to read that entirely. The world system is really theirs. And the Russians at this point, there's still a lot of Jewish influence in that country. Tremendous. It never really went away. Some of it did. To Putin's credit, he tried to get rid of some of these people. But, you know, that's pretty difficult. And he also has to play in the playing field described by them. You know, so he's got the UN to contend with, and he plays it. You know, he's using their language and their words. So is he really their guy or really not? I don't know. I think he's done a lot for Russia, but that country was in such desperate, desperate condition after 75 years of this brutal rule that, you know, one thing I noticed at that time that I was there, I did wind up the next day going to the American Embassy and finding this little place I was going to stay in. And these girls, sweet little Russian girls, wanted my passport. And I said, oh, no. I'm not giving this up. They were very frightened. They were trying to force me to do it just because they wanted to comply with the rules. I said, no way. Absolutely not. But what I saw in the people was a tremendous amount of fear. And it has to be that way. I mean, they had had several generations in this very brutal state. And that breaks your spirit. I mean, Americans are getting a taste of it now because there's this increasing police state. I mean, this is nothing compared to what.
But the version in America is a mix of this real just materialism and consumerism too, though.
Yeah.
It's a new form of communism. But if you look at Bolshevik kind of communism. What is it like?
It's brutal. The American version, because here, as I see it, Americans have this sense of themselves as a very independent people. It's not really so, but they think that, and they're told that all the time. And however, in the Soviet Union, it was brutal. It was physically brutal. They wanted to destroy, and they make that statement, they were going to wipe out, in order to start a new state, they were going to wipe out the ruling class, what came before. So it was a police state, you know, in boots. In America, the people are being seduced through the media. And it goes on constantly. It's just constantly being lied to and set up and in many ways isolated from the world stage because of American militarism, and isolated anyway because they're very disconnected from their European roots. And they get this consumerism, but consumerism through a corporate state. And I think it's just a subtle, I mean, first of all, the big capitalists funded communism. So they're funding the corporate state. I mean, this is another version. It's not free enterprise, true free enterprise.
Yeah, it's funny. I was in Times Square not too long ago, and it was my definition of hell. You know, it's just like diversity from around the world, and then it was all these big box stores and chains and just cheap consumer goods, and all these people want to be in this country to come like see these ads in Times Square, and they just want to eat all the crappy food and they want to buy everything, and this is disgusting to me, you know. But then also there's a layer of, you know, political correctness and you can't think this way and whites are bad, but it's like in a mix with Disneyland and totalitarianism. It's very messed up.
It's very weird. Yeah, I mean, it's a tacky country at this point. Yeah. To me, it's just, it's box stores, gas stations, junky movies, endless programming. I mean, everywhere you turn, you're being confronted with some kind of media, TV 24/7, 8,389 television stations, radio, movies on your iPod, movies on your this, that, and the next thing. So it never stops, and people, and the cell phone, I mean, just the whole kind of electronic overstimulation, and the junky media, and the junk from China we buy, this just trashy stuff, and these cities are so weird with this influx of this huge third world population. So they've come here, you know, supposedly for wealth, and now the cities of this country are third world.
Oh, yeah. I feel like America's kind of becoming a huge death trap, because there's so much that makes you sick here. I mean, you can do the pharmaceuticals and the vaccines, yeah, and eat the GMOs, yeah, and then be poisoned in all these other ways. So I almost feel like, all right, well, maybe we could just let America be the multicultural melting pot, you know, because these people are going to kill themselves off with how sick everything's become here. And then we could just go back to Europe and make Europe great.
That could happen, because the population has been weakened here slowly. And it is through vaccines and junky food and junky TV and no education. And again, the economy is beginning to stumble. And it's a communist state. I mean, a bunch of $8 an hour jobs.
What do you think about Bernie Sanders? I know he has a communist background, but nobody points out his communist background, but they keep looking at Trump, because David Duke has been talking about Trump on his show being supportive of certain things. He hasn't endorsed him, of course, but as a strategic move, he's been supporting Trump because he likes certain things. But I don't know if you watch the lamestream news, but it's constantly been Trump and KKK. They're trying to link him with that, but nothing about Bernie Sanders and his communist past.
Of course not. Of course not. A lot of money, a lot of Jewish money got behind Bernie Sanders. Sheldon Adelson. He was behind him. And they put their money behind everybody. They were behind Bernie Sanders on the left, and then they're behind Hillary, and then they're also behind Rubio, the bathhouse boy, and then Ted Cruz. It's just
phone party,
it's so
boy.
Weird. It's so weird. It's sad. And it's all this kind of jumbly stuff. It creates confusion. It just creates insanity. I mean, you look at this, it's sad. I mean, certainly the people that started this country made a lot of sacrifice to do so. It wasn't easy. And this is what they got. And they keep being told, well, this is the greatest country on earth.
I know, it's funny. It makes me sad when I hear, like, make America great again. I mean, it just sounds like something out of the movie Idiocracy. Like, that's how low we've gotten, you know? And actually, my husband and I were talking about this the other day. Did you see the movie Idiocracy?
I think I did.
Because there is a figure in there, I think, is it Biff? Yeah, I mean, and he's in these big towers, and he almost looks like Trump. It was almost prophetic. You have to rewatch that part. It's interesting.
Really? Okay. So it's staged. I mean, he could be just staged.
Or it's just something in the collective consciousness that just kind of manifested, you know, like it was something that was going to be a pivotal point in time. Because I see a lot of whites are waking up. I know Trump is just, you know, hitting some of the basics, but there's a lot of basics I agree with. But it is starting to move white people in a different way, waking them up, arousing something, I feel.
Yeah, it is. I mean, he's tapped into that, and there's different ways of looking at it. Yes, finally. The people in this country are beginning to get part of the story. But, you know, it also helps to kind of cultivate a race war. And that's happening. And that's, to me, very obvious. And this media, again, Hollywood, who owns Hollywood, and all this cultivation of black hatred and all this resentment. I mean, just the rap music, just that stuff. I mean, that's not hate speech. So you have some blacks who really are, you know, the flash mobs and the increasing violence. I mean, it's all being brought up to a boiling point. And then you have the Mexicans thrown into the stew. And he only goes after the Mexicans, the Muslims. But, I mean, that's understandable because immigration is something you can kind of somewhat talk about.
I think he thinks a lot of these things, but he just doesn't come out and say it. I mean, really, let's be honest. I mean, if you break down, let's make America great again. It's make America white again, right? You
know? Right. But he's not going to say that.
No.
He's going to talk about money and jobs, and that's what's safe. That's what you can say. So, you know, so we'll see what happens. I mean, it certainly is being sped up. That I do feel. It's kind of insanely so.
Now, if it gets in, are you going to vote? Because I know there's lots of people, you know, that listen to alternative media that don't believe in voting. I've been that person for many years. People think that it's rigged, and I'm sure it is. But are you going to vote? Maybe it does make a difference.
Maybe it does. It would say something. Yeah, I've been a person that's been turned off to it all for a long time. But if it would be interesting to see, you know, how they handle it at the end. Will he get in? I mean, if you go out there and vote, you'll make sure he gets in, supposedly. But of course, there's another aspect of this people don't think about. The country is voted, the president is voted on by a handful of cities and a handful of states. It's the Electoral College. They can always swing it. And that's why this was all set up. And that's why all these foreigners were brought into the cities and why the blacks were brought out of the South. And they now control the big votes. New York, Philly, Chicago, LA, that pretty much decides it. Miami. So it'll be interesting to see, because we have had an election where the people in the country, the white people, didn't want, you know, the leftists. I can't even remember which election was as it got thrown. I think it was to the Clintons. Yeah.
Kansas was interesting because he lost there, right? I think Cruz won there. I mean, Cruz is just a slime ball. I don't know how anyone could support that guy. I mean, ugh, creepy, you know? But Kansas, there was thousands of people lined up outside to vote that couldn't get in to vote. They actually said, oh, we ran out of ballots or whatever. So something fishy happened there. How do you run out of ballots or not facilitate everyone voting, right?
Right. Did they run out of ballots? Will they run out of them in New York City? Of course not. So, yeah, it's crazy. But, I mean, even if you don't do that, I mean, you can toy with it at the electronic level, at the machine levels, the Diebold machines that count the votes. Well, I think those aren't those located in Israel?
Yeah, exactly. The company that's
running them. Ridiculous. Yeah. The company that's running them, right. So, it's who knows?
You have a few years on me. I mean, how do you see things shaking out? What do you think that we as a movement, where should we be poised? What are some things that we could do differently? What are you seeing?
What I see, of course, is this divisiveness and infighting. And that's sad, but it's okay because, you know, we're like that as people. It's one of our failings.
Yes, it's very annoying.
It's annoying.
It can be very high school at times. That's why I brought up the White Army. I think I admire that there was these different groups, you know, little nuances, but they could get together and fight the big enemy. And that's what it's going to take, you know. We can't be fighting over little trivial stuff and being paranoid. It's just childish.
Yeah, it is. And it will take, sad to say, I think it will take violence. And it will come to that. And that will determine, because the thing is also, you don't really know. I know that a lot of people are armed in this country. And that's a good thing. But are they really an army at this point? I don't know. I'm just not in a position to know that. But they would have to be. I mean, we are coming up against a military in this country that is, of course, one of the reasons for the Mexicans is to fill the army up with Mexicans. And as a couple of years ago, the American military was half white males, the, you know, white females, smattering of them. And then the other half, more or less, was black Mexican. The other half was half and half them. Well, that's going to continue. As they bring these people in, they're going to be more and more in the military. There's DHS, which is an internal police force. There's the militarization of the police. How is that going to break out? Frightening stuff, actually, if you look at that aspect of it. And so if you have a movement of people who are divisive, also we're weakened because, well, there's strength and weakness, I guess. We're more or less not in the big cities anymore. So we've lost control of the cities. We've lost control of the ports. We don't have a southern border. So will people come together in the countryside? I don't know. I live in a small town that's mostly white right now. These people don't have a clue.
Isn't that sad?
I mean, they're welcoming diversity. It's like, oh my God.
Yeah, it's just really sad. I feel like after this is over, we're going to lose a lot of people, but that's okay. You know, I think it's the strong survive in the end. You know, we were talking about the city earlier. We were recently at Columbia University. I've been to Duke. You know, we've walked around other Ivy League schools and hardly saw any white students.
That's
so I know, and we're still 65% of the population and we're not represented in the university. So I think we'll see some interesting things as white kids get pushed out when they can't get, I don't want them in these indoctrination centers anyway, good riddance, you know, but as they're pushed out of the schools or the workplace, they're going to have to rise up to another level just to overcome. And we might see some interesting things shaking out.
Yeah, as they come to realize that, and yeah, because the whole university system isn't, as you say, it's indoctrination, and indoctrinates all these new arrivals to hate us. That's basically it. So they don't want white kids hearing that stuff. So maybe they'd wise up. Some don't, because some of them buy into it, and that's sad. But I don't, you know, that's kind of, I watch friends of mine who are liberal still, and I watch their kids. I just try to figure out, okay, at 20, you say everything your parents do, some do, especially if you're on the left, because that's supposed to be the revolutionary force in the country. But I wonder what they'll be like in 10, 15, 20 years as things get much tougher. And they have to. They have to get tougher in terms of crime. They have to get tougher in terms of the economy. Because the plan is to break down the economy of this country. That's one of the plans. And that's pretty much almost done. And I'm not talking about jobs at Walmart.
Well, that's another good area that we should be focusing on, is getting self-sufficient. Because we can't be, you know, depending on working for a lot of these companies. And we already know a lot of people that are being outed, if you will, at work and being fired. So it's about becoming more self-sufficient, I think, is a good step, a good thing to plan for right now.
Absolutely. I mean, and also, just wanted to bring this up. Some of the people who survived in the Soviet Union, I mean, they cleaned out a lot of the farmers, but still people who went out to the country were safer, which is interesting because, you know, you have these, how can you really police countryside? So, But of course, this is a different era technologically. There is electronic surveillance. It's everywhere. And so that presents another challenge. But we do need to network. That's what we should learn from our enemies, who are the master networkers of the universe. And they really are. They're really incredible. If you look at their capacity to take over societies, I mean, you got to kind of doff your hat and say, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's true.
It's incredible. 52% of the members of the Communist Party at that time of history that we're talking about were Jewish, and they're only 1.8% of the population. That's masterful organization.
Yeah.
It really is. And are we disorganized because we've been living in this strange country that's all based on kind of idiot entertainment, and it does splinter people. The whole system does that, keeps you in a cubicle. Or is this some of our own temperament that we lean towards individualism, which is good to a point, but not to the point where we're destroying ourselves? We need to work together. We need to learn how to do that.
Well, I wanted to get back to the Russian Revolution and see if there was any other points that we left out that you need to add in to this conversation.
Okay, yes. As a matter of fact, I want to go back to a number. 100 million white Christians in Russia under Bolshevism were killed, according to the Boston Globe, in 1998. So that's an amazing number of people.
Wow.
Destroyed out of a society. All those people, that horrifying life they had led, culminated in their deaths. And, of course, they never had families. So the population of Europe was decimated. And we're not even talking about the wars. That's another subject. Lots more millions dead. You mentioned also about Estonia and Latvia, and I'm finding this number of the massacres. There were massacres. I don't know the number in Latvia and Estonia, but there were 400,000 Volga Germans sent up to Siberia. The number that they give for the people from Russia and the surrounding nations sent to Siberia was 40 million. That's a lot.
Mm.
I mean, it's so massive that it's kind of unbelievable. But it's not. You have to stop and think about unbelievable stories. And there's one I can think of that's been circulating with the number 6 million attached to it.
I was going to ask about that one.
But that's another story for another time. But you know what? They had a couple of years to do that in, supposedly. Well, the Soviet system existed for 75 years. And they had Siberia. So it's a lot more believable.
Yeah, they had a long time to kill people.
They had a long time. And going back, the study of, how long it lasted, a lot of people say, well, the Jews didn't really control it for just at the very beginning, maybe. But actually, Stalin, now he's not supposed to be Jewish. His three wives were Jewish. And his mass murderer was Lazar Kaganovich. This man was known as the Wolf of the Kremlin. He was Jewish. He was the one among several, because the gulags were controlled by Jews. And, we might bring that subject up in another conversation. I can find the names of the people running those gulags. Also, the military. At least 100 generals in the Soviet Army were Jewish. And I don't think of Jews as being military people.
No.
Nobody does. So that was a fascinating statistic. But anyway, they still had power as late as Khrushchev, who boasted to the Israeli ambassador, and this was, I guess, in the 50s, and he said, my wife is Jewish, as are most of the wives of the members of the Presidium.
Oh, this is a quote?
So, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So where was that from?
I'm going to have to find it. I mean, it's going to take some time. I will. The next time we talk, I'll start with that. So they had power in that state, and they didn't surrender power under Stalin. Yes, there were Jews purged, there were Gentiles purged. It was a violent kind of guy, but it wasn't specifically directed at them. And we again are given that impression in this country to make it seem as though that they suffered so and so on and so forth, when in fact they were still in charge. And of course, Stalin wasn't his name Dugashvili, son of a Jew?
I'm not sure about that.
I'm not sure that, but I have heard that. But anyway, they pass him off as a Jesuit, so.
I just remember hearing that, you know, Stalin was killing Jews and he was anti-Semitic. I'm sure you've heard that too.
Yeah, yeah. Given the power structure, and of course it's the wife thing too. That's a way of controlling, that's a very old technique of controlling men through their wives, because they're a spy on them.
Did he have children, Stalin?
Yes, he did. Oh, that's a strange story. His son was in the military, and he had been captured by the Germans, and his father disowned him. What did anything to do with him? Said, yeah, not a nice guy, but we know that.
Well, Sencha, thank you for your time today. I've appreciated. I always like to hear about this subject. We rarely hear about the Russian Revolution. And as you pointed out earlier, all the movies always glorify the Bolsheviks as these, you know, romantic, great guys, right? So thanks for bringing out some of these facts.
Well, you're welcome. And yeah, it's important. Yeah, I think we do need to talk about it because can it happen here?
Yeah, I think it's going to happen in a different way. The American Bolshevik, it's already rising. It's already happening. And a lot of these people, I think, are very violent inside. If they could have an opportunity to line up white people and kill them, they probably would.
Yeah, it's already happening in some ways, in the violence in the cities. But it could be orchestrated. That would be a lot more frightening and a lot more damaging. I mean, then it turns into mass murder.
Also, you have a website, right? Tell us about that.
Yes, I do. It is called untoldtales.net. And I have a couple audio files on this subject of Russia in general, because it's a fascinating story. Their whole history is fascinating, but of the Bolshevik Revolution and its source. And I have, you know, links to lots of information if people want to read it. But you can hear about it, you can read it, and take a look. Take a real honest look at this story. I think it'll begin to open your eyes to another aspect of the truth. So thank you again for having me on.
So we got a subscription to stream lamestream news, both Fox and CNN, for analysis, and it's outrageous the filth coming out of both left and phony right. Both sides have united against Trump. Republicans are talking about supporting Hillary over Trump. In fact, Fox is harder against Trump than CNN. They are so cucked that they'd rather vote for Hillary than to support a racist fascist like Trump. And what he's suggesting isn't even remotely extreme. That's how far gone things are. But it is a great thing seeing turmoil among conservatives and Republicans because they're phony, cowardly sellouts and it needs to be broken up. A true opposition is beginning to form and many disillusioned Republicans are slowly waking up and finding people like us. And I'd bet if you actually spoke to many Trump supporters, they'd probably pick up on a lot more than you think. Remember, alt media has always been years ahead of the masses, but it always catches up. Things we spoke about a few years ago are now in lamestream conversation. So what we talk about now, it will get there too. I also think it's helpful that Ann Coulter has made comments about why one standard for Israel and another for America. All of this is helping. It doesn't mean you agree or endorse 100%, but you have strategic points of agreement. I do not agree that just because someone becomes popular or listened to that they are controlled opposition. Remember, Hitler was a populist movement. He had support by the masses. It was mainstream at that point. Many conspirators think Hitler was bought, whereas others say, no, there's no proof. Same goes with Trump. It's mind-blowing, though, the comparison between Trump and Hitler, because Trump is far from a national socialist. Trump said he remains neutral on Israel, and that's enough for him to be called an anti-Semite and compared with Hitler. But Jews wouldn't even have Israel if it weren't for Hitler. Trump isn't dumb, and he may be aware of players who really control things. Newt Gingrich told Fox News' Bill O'Reilly that the establishment is scared of Donald Trump because he, quote-unquote, didn't belong to a secret society and wasn't involved in any of the rituals associated with such groups. I think there's something to that. While I don't view Trump as the savior of European Americans, I see the zeal around him and the fire it's sparking in people. Whether they know it or not, they feel the power at a rally because they're in an arena with 20,000 European Americans united on a cause, and that feels extraordinary. It has become a movement. I briefly attended a rally and I felt the energy. I'm sure Hillary will become president in the end, but it's good things are shaking up in America because the worst thing would be to have more of the same. If you don't listen to the show from our website, visit redicecreations.com or radio314.com to find our radio archives with over 1,000 shows, videos, and news. And since we cannot do this without you and need your help, please consider a donation or sign up for a Red Ice membership to gain full access to all our shows. We do appreciate the support. Enjoy the rest of your day or night. We'll talk again next week.